This is Jeremy Bassetti, and you're listening to Travel Writing World, a podcast featuring interviews with travel writers about their work and about the business and craft of travel writing. You can find the episode show notes, free travel writing resources, and much more at travelwritingworld.com. Hello, this is episode 111 of the Travel Writing World podcast. On today's episode, I chat with Michael Kerr, the creator of Deskbound Traveler, which is a website and a blog dedicated to exploring the literature of travel, nature, and place. Michael brings with him a rich background as former deputy travel editor at the Daily Telegraph. This episode is more a chat than an interview. In it, we talk about the transformation of travel media from storytelling to a more utilitarian approach driven by the internet and market forces. We also talk about social and environmental trends in travel literature and highlight how these themes have revitalized the genre. And lastly, we chat a bit about Stanford's Travel Writing Awards, the shortlist, and the mystery behind the shortlist selection process. All that and more on today's episode. So now, here is my conversation with Michael Kerr. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good. So you're the author of Deskbound Traveler, and it's a website and blog that covers books basically about travel and nature and place. But you used to be an editor, I think, at the Telegraph. So if you don't mind, why don't you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, when I started the site, my site just over 10 years ago, I was deputy travel editor on the Daily Telegraph. I was looking after so many pages that I had trouble getting out on the road to. I had trouble getting out of the office for a sandwich, let alone getting out on the road to write. the site's name was partly a joke at myself and the position I found myself in, but it's also an expression of my firm belief in the transporting power of words, in what D.H. Lawrence in Mornings in Mexico summed up as one little individual looking at a bit of sky and trees, then making little marks on paper.
So you, from what I understand, part of the reason that you started this blog, in addition to what you just said, was perhaps also because of the changing landscape of travel media or the nature of travel writing in kind of standard publications and the dailies and those types of things. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, that's certainly true. When I first started in travel, writers were commissioned essentially to do some storytelling from foreign parts. And you could exploit the baggy nature of travel to take in your passions, and you could include nature, memoir, history, and get away with all sorts of things. And provided you produced a rounded piece, the editor was happy. And then I think one of the developments of the web was the need for lists and headlines that said things like, the 10 best ways to do this, the five wildest places in the world. And it seemed that the whole drive in travel was to become much more utilitarian, and storytelling was disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And I started my site in the last year. I went on to 4-day week, and one of the things I did was to start running extracts from books that I loved and promoting great storytelling. In both words and pictures.
So books and the kind of waning landscape of travel media being overly, in your estimation, consumed by service-oriented pieces, helpful content, the domain of guidebooks basically taking over. What many of us want to read is kind of travel narratives and those types of things.
Yeah, it was essentially a drive for practical material, and my site was a reaction to that.
Yeah,
Deskbound Traveler, and the kind of people you interview regularly on your site. The point of it is to be determinedly impractical. to support storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
While you offer advice to practitioners of the trade.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just thinking here, like, I wonder, you know, you have a long career in publishing and those types of things, and I wonder, like, you cited the web, but I wonder kind of why there was this general trend towards service. Is that because, do you think maybe because that's where the money was, and that having articles that talked about the 10 best places to eat a taco or something would generate clicks and therefore ad revenue, and this is all kind of like this market driven thing? Or
I think profitability was a huge part of it. Yeah. And travel sections in Britain certainly bring in a hell of a lot of money in newspapers. And you know, clickbait essentially is much harder to generate from an impractical piece that's all to do with the quality of the writing and the storytelling.
Right. It's this it sounds like literary fiction to a certain degree, as compared to, you know, as compared to genre fiction. Literary fiction just seems like it's a harder thing to market. There isn't a clear value proposition except for good writing. Yeah. Or a good story.
Well, I grew up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, and I could have trained as a journalist in Belfast. One of my sisters had been at the College of Business Studies there doing a bilingual secretarial course. I could have done my journalism course there. And Trish would come home at weekends and her talk would all be of bag searches and bomb scares. And I thought, I don't want to train in Belfast. I want to get the hell out of here. I don't want people, when I'm at a meeting, asking themselves, is this guy a Protestant journalist or a Catholic one, and how much should we tell him? So I went to London to get away from that. And I was a regular reader in those days of Melody Maker and Sounds and NME. And I had notions of being a rock critic. And at the end of my course, we were encouraged to apply anywhere and everywhere we saw a vacancy. So I dropped a note to a magazine called Police Review, which was looking for a new recruit, which was an entirely different beat. And the new editor there was a guy called Colin Simpson, who had worked on the Insight team at the Sunday Times. And I think Colin was a mischievous guy. I think he hired me partly because I had a much broader Irish accent then, and I think he relished the idea of having me talk to senior coppers about firearms policy on the telephone.
And now here you are, fast forward several decades, and you're writing about new books, focusing on kind of the literary side of writing about place and travel and nature. I think you're...
Yes, I mean, you have come across this. I think travel as a form is said to be dying, you know, every 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. Herself said in an introduction to a collection of her essays in 1972 that it was a fading genre. And then she published another half dozen collection of essays. And I feel over the last few years that travel writing has been energized by its engagement with issues such as climate change, and with journeys that are forced rather than longed for, the kind of journeys made by refugees and migrants. And on the climate front, I'm thinking of Chesapeake Requiem by Earl Swift, which came out a few years ago. And it's about Tangier Island, which, according to a study in Nature, I think in 2015, could be the first town in the US to disappear under the waves as a result of rising sea levels.
Interesting. What was the name of that book?
Tangier Island. Okay. By Earl Swift.
Yeah, and you mentioned the kind of climate direction, the nature direction, the climate crisis as kind of being a focus in some of these travel narratives. But I'm also thinking here about kind of social justice issues and social concerns as also taking kind of going to the forefront in some of these narratives. And I know that you were big on a book last year called Solito, and there are many other examples of this. Do you think kind of these social issues and climate issues are kind of two of the major trends in travel books today?
I think they are. And I think, as I say, I think they've given energy to the form.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books I'm most looking forward to next year is, well, later this year, is Scattered by a Guardian reporter called Amna Bodine. And it seems to me to follow on from The Naked Don't Fear the Water by Matthew Akins. And Akins was a reporter working in Afghanistan and one of the fixers and helpers who was most useful to him needed to get out of Afghanistan he didn't have papers to make it possible. So Akins very bravely joined him on the underground route. And then, as you mentioned, there's Solito by Abir Zamora. And Zamora, as a 10-year-old, traveled from El Salvador to rejoin his parents in the United States. And I think he was accompanied on the first stretch by his uncle to Guatemala. And then thereafter, he was on his own. The story is heartrending in some ways because of how powerfully he recreates what he went through as a child. And it's heartening in others when you see the odd individual, the border guard, who is gentle and helpful.
You know, I was just thinking as you were talking about that, you'd mentioned that these new focuses, let's say, you said they've invigorated the form. And I was just kind of ruminating on that because I think it's so right. And we sometimes hear kind of claims that these social justice issues are kind of destroying the genre or whatever. But there seems to me that there's plenty of room for these types of stories that frankly need to be told to exist alongside these old kind of classic travel narratives that are still around, right? They're not going away as a
Definitely.
Result.
And I see Eland, which is a great publisher in the UK of travel classics,
mm-hmm.
are bringing out later this year one of Robert Byron's books.
Just to say, you've written about some books that you're looking forward to in 2024 on your blog, and the article is called Words from the Road for 2024. And some of these books that you're referencing here are on your list. And frankly, this is a very nice list of books.
It's quite a long list as well.
Yes.
I don't know about you, but I sometimes pine for the days pre-internet when you got yourself a guidebook. You talked to a few people who said, here's a novel that's great on the place you're going to. And then you arrived and you went into a local bookshop and you happened on things. And one of the things I happened on in Maryland was a book by a guy called Randall Pfeffer, Watermen, about the Tillman Islanders who fish on the Chesapeake Bay.
Mm.
And it's a wonderfully vivid, salty account of one place. But it's not something I knew about before I went there. These days, I'd go onto Google and I'd hunt these things down beforehand. And then I'd have an intimidating list in the same way as you and I, every time we go on social media or we flick through or we're directed elsewhere, we come across, here's another book I've got to add to a tottering TBR pile.
Yeah, and yet, you mentioned this kind of discovery, the joy in the discovery of books in the days long gone. But I think it's Nick Hunt, who is working with...
For John Murray Publishers.
That's yes. Right, John Murray's. And I think it's called Journeys. And I think what he's trying to do is to find these old, forgotten, out of, much like Eland, old books that have fallen out of publication, and just, you know, finding and discovering these forgotten books. And I think that's just a wonderful thing, and a reminder that, geez, there's so many books out there waiting to be discovered that some of these lists cannot possibly cover, just the wealth of literature out there.
Yeah, well, I've had a reminder since I posted my roundup. You know, I've had a couple of books that have, one in particular that came out, I think only within the last week or so, and it's by a guy called Alistair Humphreys, who's extremely traveled. He's cycled around the world, walked across India, rode the Atlantic. But his new book is titled Local. And he's talking about searching for nature and wildness, as the summary puts it, in the unprepossessing surroundings covered by the Ordnance Survey map around his own home.
Yeah, it's a wonderful premise. From what I understand, he got the Ordnance Survey map and just in his kind of local area and kind of decided to exhaust the map, walk through the map, I believe, and step foot into every, you know, square grid of that map for a year, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And that's like, I guess, another trend that we've seen, especially since the pandemic, is this kind of this inward turn, I guess, let's call it, traveling locally. And this book might be the apotheosis of of that trend, right?
Well, I think it's partly as well because travel writers, and Sarah Wheeler has acknowledged this in her most recent book, that we'll increasingly be told, you know, should we be flying at all? Should you be going to the other side of the world when your carbon footprint is contributing to the climate crisis? And should you, an outsider, be coming in and telling the stories of a place when the people who live in that place are better able to do it?
Right.
You know, is it presumptuous of you, as the well-heeled Brits used to do in the old days, arrive and summarize a place from the heights?
Yeah, you know, but what about this notion of not necessarily telling the story of a place, but telling our stories in places instead of trying to be the definitive guide, the encyclopedic guide to a place? I'm just, you know, I'm an expert of my own experience. Why don't I talk about that a little bit?
Yes.
So what else do you have here on your list? I see that you have, well, you mentioned the Alistair Humphreys, and one of the things, I think you mentioned some of his exploits around the world, and just to kind of tie that to the Stanford's Travel Book of the Year, I think he went on one of his trips with a nominee for this year's prize, Leon McCarran, whose new book, Wounded Tigress, A River Journey Through the Cradle of Civilization, is getting a lot of attention lately.
It is. I'm a little disappointed in the Stanford list, in that Sarah Wheeler's book isn't there. That was one of my favorites. But it's a book titled Glowing Still, and she's looking back on her formative years, her life on the road and her travels over 40-plus years. And it's partly a bloke about being a woman and what was seen as a man's trade. Mm-hmm. The bloke business of seeing how dead you can get, as she puts it. There's personal and social history. She draws in feminism, environmentalism, and literary criticism. And it's funny. The question she's most often asked, she says, is whether anything has scared her. The answer, the John Lewis curtain department terrifies me most. She can cope when she's out on the road with all sorts of hazards and possibilities of dangers. She doesn't want to be stuck in a place where she has to choose the drapes for the window.
That's great.
John Lewis is a big department store here.
Okay. That's funny. Yeah, that's interesting. Like I've always wondered how the shortlist gets compiled. It's a bit of a mystery. I really want to know how the sausage gets made here.
You've been a judge in the past, haven't you? You're not this year.
Right, but the way that in my experience, the way that works is when I got on the panels, the shortlist had already been determined. So the judges basically need to sort through the shortlist, and how the shortlist gets compiled, it's a mystery.
You mentioned Leon McCarran's book. I think one of the things that's unusual in it is that he travels with a team. His partner, mm-hmm. Emily Garthwaite, who's a photojournalist and artist.
Wonderful photographer.
Who's a Swiss filmmaker. And various local fixers and environmentalists. And that could have been a handicap, but he doesn't let it become one. It still feels like a book driven by a personal quest. You know, the usual advice to travel writers is go it alone. Steinbeck said in Travels with Charlie, two or more people disturb the ecologic complex of an area. But then the tigress is already pretty disturbed, which is what the book's about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what we lose with the death of this great river and what can be done to save it.
Right. Yeah. And interestingly, you know, there's the stereotype about the kind of solo travel writer. And we know most of them, or many of them, don't actually go solo. some of the classics, classic writers that we all love, they lull us into this kind of fairy tale. That they're this hero traveling alone, which in most cases is not true. But lately I've seen, and I didn't get this with Leon's book, but it seems, I think thanks to the rise of social media and those platforms, that there's this kind of, you know, performative aspect of the travel or the walk or the voyage. You know, we see this a lot with people streaming, you know, their trips. And some of the recent books, I think there was one or two last year in the Stanford's list that also involved kind of a crew, you know, the documentation of a trip, and that's certainly interesting to me. I haven't read all of these on the list, but I know for sure Tim Hannigan's book and Tom Parfitt's book. Most of those trips were done alone. And I'm assuming Mary Caldwell's book, The Pilgrimage to Santiago, also was a solo trip, but I'm not sure about that.
I think she traveled alone, yes.
Yeah.
And for a lot of the time, because she was on the Camino in between lockdowns, there were very few other people around. And that's on a route that's normally walked by, I think, 300, 350,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
Have you read a few of the titles on the Stanford shortlist?
Just three. The McCarran's book, Hannigan's book, and Parfitt's book, all of whom I've spoken with for the podcast. But I'm eager to dip my toes into the other ones. I've just been kind of short on time. Have you read them all?
No.
No?
I try to fit in as many as I can, but I don't always manage it. I think as you say, the judging process used to be very different for the Stanford Dorman title
right.
book. I can remember when Sarah Wheeler chaired it one year, and I was one of the judges, and we drew up the shortlist ourselves, and we had several meetings. And
that seems like that's how it should be done, in my opinion.
So. Yeah, so rather than you're being presented with a long list or with a short list, it's arrived at by people drawing up the long list, whittling it down, and then having arguments across the table over which should be at the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seems like a sensible way.
But I think that the Stanford list went through a period, I think, of taking in too many things. I think in 2019, 2020, the short lists ran to 57 books in 9 categories. including memoir, photography, adventure travel, and books for children. And I think that the travel book of the year, the Stanford Dolman Prize, got a bit lost in all that.
Mm.
You know, some of the books that I would have thought would have been possible winners ended up with the memoir category.
Right. Right. And some of the books...
They have whittled it down again, I think, possibly for commercial reasons, as well as spreading themselves a bit thin. And I hope that the main award, what should be the main award, will get a bit more prominence.
Mm-hmm. I think last year the pandemic threw a wrench into the awards, I think. But last year is when they, as you mentioned, whittled down most of the categories. So I think this year, Fiction with a Sense of Place is back, but that was gone last year, as was the food and drink and the photography book and the illustration book, as you mentioned. And now it's just kind of the jewel in the crown, in my opinion, which is the travel book of the year. And yeah, okay, good.
You can argue, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, that, you know, Fiction with a Sense of Place is perhaps a distraction, because there's already a prestigious award here, the Ondaatje Prize, which is worth £10,000.
Wow.
And for fiction, for poetry, or for non-fiction that best captures, as they put it, the spirit of a place. And previous winners of that have included Peter Pomerantsev for his book on Russia and Putin's manipulation of the media, and Pascal Petit for a book of poems, Mama Amazonica, which is partly about the river and the rainforest and partly about mental illness.
Yeah, interesting. But, you know, I'm glad that they have it and they're able to, you know, offer writers an additional attention.
No, I agree. I've long been a big customer at Stanford's, quite often before trips, going in there, finding books and guidebooks and maps. And I'm also hugely impressed by the support they've given to travel writing generally over the years.
Mm-hmm. There's really no other institution out there like them.
No.
We are getting short on time here. No thanks to our technical issues here. But I just wanted to say thank you for chatting with me about your books that you're looking forward to in 2024 and about the award. Hopefully we can chat more about books in the future.
That would be great.
Deskboundtraveler.com. And for the Americans, that's Traveler with two L's. There you'll find a beautifully redesigned blog with a lot of articles about books from the road, books on travel, books on place, books on nature, photo books, just all types of good stuff. Is that the best place we can find you online?
It is indeed. Yep.
Very good, Michael. Well, thank you again. And sorry about the technical issues. Hopefully we can...
No, not at all. It's great. Great to talk to you. And I hope we can do it again soon.
You can find the episode show notes and much more at travelwritingworld.com. Please remember to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app. And if you find the show valuable, please consider leaving a review or supporting the show with only a few dollars a month at travelwritingworld.com/support.